On the first Sunday College Football Inquirer of the season, we talk Texas, Ohio State. What happened to Arch? He did not live up to our dreams and hopes and expectations. Does that mean he stinks? Probably not, but we'll talk about it. We'll also talk about the most shocking result of the day, Florida State thumping Alabama in Tallahassee. Was it in honor of Lee Corso? Also, I was at LSU Clemson. Best football game of the day. Two good teams. Godfrey has questions. Today on the College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer. And before I introduce everybody, I want to let you know you can watch our beautiful faces on the Yahoo streaming network. We have a new network where you can watch us anytime. If you turn on your television on that home screen, you probably see the Yahoo Sports Network. It's available on all leading FAST services. That's free ad-supported television. Also, you can find us 24/7 on yahoosports.tv, and you can watch our show and all the other excellent shows that Yahoo produces. That's which I'm going to be on one of them next week. I'm going to be on Yahoo Sports Daily. So give it a shot. Guys, Ross Dellinger, Stephen Godfrey.
Yo.
Quite a day. Godfrey's at home.
Yes,
Ross
sir.
Is in South Beach, but was in Columbus yesterday. I am in lovely Commerce, Georgia, headed to Atlanta to go see South Carolina play Virginia Tech. But I was at LSU Clemson last night in lovely Clemson, South Carolina. Guys, what a wonderful way to open the college football season. And Ross, I got to ask, just from seeing it on TV, it looked amazing. What was the atmosphere like at the Horseshoe as Ohio State began the defense of its national title against Texas?
It was an incredible atmosphere, Andy. Loud, just, I expected actually more Texas fans. Like, it was just knowing how sort of last year went with Tennessee and how they traveled and how Ohio State fans sold their playoff tickets. That did not happen this year. Like, it was loaded with scarlet. And it was really, really loud. And they were like, they were packed in there at kickoff. It was not, you know, it was a noon kickoff. And so a lot of times, especially often in the SEC footprint, you get late arriving crowds. This was not that. They were all out there. They were ready to go. It was loud. It was awesome. And outside the stadium, obviously you had a couple of really, you know, these pregame shows going on, right? You had this big noon kickoff going on with all the Dave Portnoy drama and his debut. And then you sort of had kind of the opposite going on College Game Day, which was like this sort of gracious goodbye to the legend 90-year-old Lee Corso. So that was playing out outside. That was really interesting. Then obviously they brought it inside. And then boom, we had kickoff, and we had from the very jump a very clearly rattled quarterback for Texas with the famous last name. And that's kind of obviously the theme, sort of. I know Godfrey has more on some of the play calling stuff with Texas, but certainly the theme, like throughout the stadium and the news conference, all the coverage, is the struggles of Arch against a defense in led by Matt Patricia, the new defensive coordinator at Ohio State. And Sark went into some detail about, at least in the first half, how Matt Patricia's defense and his secondary, at least the Ohio State secondary, can sort of confused Arch, and he sort of acknowledged that he was confused on some coverages, and it looked that way.
Ross, so he acknowledged the fact that it seemed like pre-snap, they were just kind of like, it wasn't amoeba style, but it was just like they were showing nothing or a version of something, and then immediately dropping into something else.
That's right.
It was as confusing a defense as the visual representation was Matt Patricia's beard, which, by the way, we just, even by DC standards, guys.
Yeah.
I know you're Lake House guys. Yeah. I get it. Like, we're all doing a version of Mountain Man these days. Like, let's hit that with a comb. Come on, guys.
I can't even grow a beard, so I'm just jealous. That's all there is to it.
I could do a methy beard, but that was an impressive beard.
Wait, did you say a messy beard or a meth
methy
beard?
Oh, no, methy. Yeah. Where it has the gaps. Yeah. Like, you won't sell me Sudafed at a Walmart.
Patchy.
Yeah.
You might
say methy. Methy. Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
I have a 14-year-old daughter. She has a messy bun some of the time. I'll have to ask her if there's such a thing as
Andy,
a methy
you're in
bun.
Commerce, Georgia. A methy beard. Look around.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yeah. Oh. One thing about Patricia.
How dare you?
Like,
I'm allowed to say that from there.
He still had the pencil in his ear despite having a laminated play sheet that was going around on social.
That's great.
But like he had the pencil, but he had a laminated play sheet. But he got to have that pencil in there,
Ross,
man.
That's the coordinator's version of the coffee shop hipster wearing the glasses they don't need. That's what it's the accessory point to emphasize the character that you're playing. At any point in that game on Saturday morning, are you going to need a number two pencil? No.
No.
Absolutely not.
No, no scantrons being filled in.
Exactly.
I figured, because we used to talk about that with Patricia as the Lions coach. He also had the pencil and a laminated play sheet. But listening to him as a podcast host during that year that Belichick was out, I do think it all makes sense now. Like, if you've listened to Matt Patricia, I mean, this is a guy who went to Rensselaer Polytechnic. Like, he fits the profile more than you think of that coffee. Well, not the coffee shop hipster, the engineer working in the coffee shop, basically.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Ross, you mentioned Arch looked confused. It reminded me a lot of when they threw him in against Georgia in the first game in Austin last year, which, by the way, that's what Kirby Smart was doing. Same thing, where the defense shows one thing pre-snap and then morphs into something completely different once the ball gets snapped. And, you know, it was fascinating to me watching because we were trying to figure out, okay, is this going to be a mega story of Arch is just he couldn't do anything? And through 3.5 quarters, he couldn't. But then at the end of the game, when it's tight, he actually he leads them on a touchdown drive. They were moving the ball. And it looked to me, the untrained eye, like Arch works well in an up-tempo system. So maybe just do that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And Sark talked about that afterward. I think he was trying to as expected, like trying to calm everybody down right on Arch. And so he talked about things like, hey, this is just the first chapter. You know, don't judge the book yet. And he spoke about the growth sort of that he saw in the second half with Arch. He said second half, you know, as Andy said, it was more like second half of the fourth quarter. That we saw that. I don't know what else we saw before that. Not a whole lot. It wasn't until 7 minutes left in the game that Arch completed a pass in the air of longer than 10 yards or at least 10 yards through the air. So he was 0 for 5, I think, with an interception before he did that, like with 7 or 8 minutes left in the game. So, but Sark did discuss, you know, the growth and he said he was encouraged and all that stuff. One thing he did mention that I thought was interesting is he actually said Arch gets better when he gets like hit. So like at halftime, they sort of went in and started running him more. Even the second quarter, actually, they started running him more. You noticed they just started running him because they actually wanted him to like take some hits because Sark thought, and maybe Arch thought too, that he sort of wakes up when he starts getting physical. So that was an interesting note as well. But the last two drives, he put some balls certainly on the money, right? And that's, we did not see that all in the first half. I mean, he underthrew probably like three receivers. He probably overthrew two more. He probably threw wide a couple times. I mean, and these were not completely open receivers. Some of them were because Ohio State did a great job in the secondary. As Godfrey said, there was a lot of confusion pre-snap. They moved around. Downs was flying all over the place. They look really good. Ohio State's, but you know, part of this discussion probably should be Ohio State, and they look really good. And actually, Julian Sayin, the quarterback, looked pretty sharp, right? Like they weren't prolific or anything like that, but they really didn't need to be.
No, nobody wants to. I get it, Manning. And by the way, super fast defense of this counter narrative from yesterday. He's a Manning. The Texas and Arch family side, as Ross talked about in our last show, spent the entire offseason downplaying this as they were going to. The media is going to hype up someone who has two uncles on Monday Night Football who have won Super Bowls. Like, no one's really at fault here. I just didn't buy yesterday a lot of this, like, well, he was overhyped. First off, it's one game. Second, it's against the defending national champions. And three, that's a really talented team. Flipping it on the other side, Ohio State's offense, I thought, had a really nice plan for the day. But I also still like Texas's defense. This result felt like everything can be true. Everything that we talked about, except for one thing I want to get into in a second in terms of Sark. But it felt like unit by unit, their offense, our defense, It felt like these are two teams that are playoff bound. The result, I think, was something to grow on for Arch. And at the same time, Ohio State really, I would say they picked up where they left off, but they, I mean, they kind of did.
Well, but what's amazing about that is eight new defensive starters and a new defensive coordinator, and they still looked like they hadn't lost anything. And that was probably the most impressive piece of it. As for the Arch thing, we were always going to overhype him. Like you said, Godfrey, that was destined to happen. And that, of course, creates a natural backlash. And you got that. You got that on Saturday because people, you know, when someone gets built up when they haven't actually achieved anything yet, people naturally are inclined to root for them to fail. And so people were loving what was going on with Arch. Arch never asked for that, as Ross pointed out in his story. So he's just trying to deal with it, which is fine. I mean, look, worst comes to worst, he's a Manning. The bank account looks good. Yeah. He's got his Warby Parker money now. So
I mean, he had commercials on.
Viore?
Yeah, he had commercials on. Yeah. I mean, you guys might have been in press boxes. He had, when I counted, four commercial breaks in the first half where there was an Arch endorsement in the block.
There was a point he had more commercials than completions.
Nice.
There was a point in the game. So,
well, speaking of that, my story, Andy, on him,
yeah,
he got what he wanted, right? He got, I mean, people are now going from he's the best quarterback in the world to the worst quarterback.
So he stinks. Exactly. Yeah. So now we know. That said, the one thing that, you know, I thought he actually might be kind of good at because of his size was a tush-push type situation. They tried that on the goal line. It didn't work, which leads me, Godfrey, into a discussion of Sark in the red zone. So on my On Three show, I have a very dedicated viewer / listener named Steve in San Antonio, who peppered me with emails all summer about Sark in the red zone. He's like, you got to pay attention to this. This is bad. It's got to get fixed. And I kind of poo-pooed it because my thing was, okay, they get to the red zone more than anybody else. If they can just get a, you know, an average red zone percentage, an average red zone TD percentage, they will be the national champions. But once again, it reared its ugly head. And it just, and you were telling us before we started recording, Steven, because you are a dedicated Atlanta Falcons fan. So Steve Sarkisian was their OC for a while. This predates his time at Texas. This may be just, this may be part of his DNA.
Steve in San Antonio, by the way, let's exchange contact info. You know, I'm always looking for a good pen pal.
I will send you his email.
And yeah.
This guy's last name is San Antonio?
Yeah, no, his name is Steve in San Antonio. So Steve in Nashville. I love San Antonio. Yeah, go to the coach's conference there.
It's not like Robert California from The Office.
That's what I thought it was. Yeah.
So Steve in Nashville, I'd love to talk to Steve in San Antonio about this. So I had someone far smarter than me. What I asked around after the game yesterday, and I asked one of my nerd buddies in the college football nerd space, Parker Fleming. You can find him at Stats of War. He professionally is an analyst and a consultant to different football teams, pro and college. And I said, can we qualify or quantify this Sark red zone LOL thing? Because when I was doing the anonymous gossip profiles for Athlon magazine a couple years ago, the beat on Sark from so many people across the industry who really like and respect him as a professional would say, greatest play caller in the world until you get to about the opponent 25, which is really, talk about damning with faint praise. That's not even faint praise. That's pretty brutal. So Parker gave me a stat that's super easy to explain. There's something called a quality drive rate. And a quality drive, if you don't want to know anything about advanced analytics, is any drive where you have one first down inside your opponent's 40. Okay? So last season, they were 15th in the country in quality drive rate, but they were 39th in points per quality drive rate. 2023, you guys remember how Texas ended the game against Washington in the playoff semifinal? 6th in the country in quality drive rate. So what that means is they're constantly putting together good offensive work. They were 107th in points per quality drive rate. This has dogged him his entire career. The play that I'm talking about, 2017 playoffs, Atlanta at Philadelphia. Malcolm Jenkins was famous because he said after the game, it's a 4th and goal to go to end the game. The Falcons are down by a score. This is basically the game. They come out in alignment where they put like Julio Jones, Mohamed Sanu, all of their weapons on one side of the field. And then on the far side of the field, they line up a fullback. Jenkins said after the game, we knew exactly what they were going to do as soon as they came out. And it's a sort of symptom or ailment that he has of always being really cute. The one that really stuck out to me, guys, and I'm sure one of y'all was at this game last year, was against Ohio State. The sequence of play calling It just kind of blew my mind. Look, there's some otherworldly talent on the field.
Caleb Downs,
Ohio State,
by the way, who was on the field yesterday,
yeah,
diagnosed that play immediately. Caleb Downs was the one who blew it up. He fires in, and it's probably like you said, Godfrey, because that's a play that we examined just ad nauseum over the summer. And one thing I noticed when I was looking back at it and watching it over 50 billion times is they were outnumbered on the side they were tossing to. So you're going wide against a very fast defense where you are outnumbered on that side. Right. That play had no chance ever. And, you know, I wonder, because if you ask people about Sark and what makes him such a good play caller between the 25s, he makes you defend the entire length and width of the field, which that's a lot of space. But once you get inside the 20-yard line, the length of the field is so compressed that you really just have to defend the width at that point, and that makes it easier. Like,
yes,
the teams that are good in the red zone are good in the red zone because they either execute flawlessly, because they have receivers who can do special things and win jump balls, that sort of thing, or because they have a line that just mauls you up front.
Physical, yeah. You're doing all the simple things better than the opponent.
Yeah, Texas has not been able to do that under Sark.
And yesterday, maybe not the greatest example of getting too cute, which is sort of the thing that's dog Sark, and I've seen it.
Tush push was actually kind of ugly. Like, you watch the tight end on that play. I don't even know if he knew when the snap was coming, because he just gets cut off immediately. Yeah. He doesn't block anybody. And it's like, okay, guys, how much did you practice this? And that's one of those things that's very hard to practice, by the way.
Yeah. It looked like, if anything, maybe that tush push call was a sort of response to this criticism. God knows, great staff self-diagnose a large portion of the offseason. They spend a lot of time like self-scouting. I'm sure that tush push was in some way a response to maybe some of the overly cute antics. But guess what? It didn't work either. It's weird to see such a hyper-talented team and program lose individual, like you were saying, Andy, those one-on-one matchups that you have to win. When you can't get cute, you have to get simple and mean. That's where Texas struggles.
You know, the best thing that came out for Texas offensively, I thought at least, was actually the pass blocking was pretty good. Like, Archer had time, especially in the first half. He had plenty of time. There's four new offensive linemen starting, and I thought they blocked really well. He just obviously early on was
when you compare that to the game of the evening. It actually contrasts even more, because those two guys were constantly in motion.
They were running for their lives.
What those DCs were doing, yeah.
So before we leave this game, I do want to we talked about Matt Patricia for Ohio State. I want to give Ryan Day and Brian Hartline their flowers as well. Brian Hartline, the receivers coach who got elevated to OC when Chip Kelly left. Ryan Day, who was the play caller before Chip Kelly. So we don't exactly know how the division of labor is going there, but the game plan, I liked it a lot. They were force feeding Jeremiah Smith the ball, which last year, the biggest criticism you could level at them was, why don't you just throw it to four every single time?
And what were the targets, Andy, against Michigan? What were the targets against Michigan?
Three.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, come on.
Yeah.
He had some drops Saturday, which was surprising.
Two drops in the first half. He had one drop all last season. So I don't know that that's necessarily going to carry over, but you did see also the focus on Jeremiah Smith opens up people like Carnell Tate, who had the best catch of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible on the goal line. You know what else, too, stuck out? The running back from West Virginia, transferred in from West Virginia, C.J. Donaldson, looked really good. You know, he ended up averaging, I think, like 3.5-4 yards a carry. A tough runner, big guy. So they've got the weapons there. You know, I left that game thinking, oh, yeah, Ohio State's going to be back again, you know, in the championship picture. I mean, it's pretty clear, despite losing, whatever, 15 NFL guys, you know, 15 draft picks or something. They're right there. They're back.
Yeah, they're stupid to say this. We're not even done with week one, but they are kind of like a Final Four team right now.
Yeah.
You feel very comfortable. Yeah. Of the teams on display yesterday, that's the one I would feel the most confident about.
Oh,
and if they needed to score...
It's not even week. It's not. It's still week. It's like half of week.
We're not
one.
Even done with week one yet.
No.
That's right.
All right, boys. Lee Corso, final headgear game, final College Game Day appearance. Back where it all started. The first time he donned the headgear was 1996. He donned Brutus Buckeye's head. Of course, he was going to put the Brutus head on again. Mm. But Lee Corso, I don't know if it was magic. I don't know if the good Lord decided to bless him on this particular day, or the college football gods, or whatever you want to say. But he was on an all-time heater. He wore a tux to the occasion, which I loved. Ross, you took a great picture of him sitting there watching the game in the press box. What was that part like?
Yeah, it was cool. Like he came up probably, you know, a few minutes in. It was probably like second quarter, and he came up to the press box, and it was when you get to that Ohio State press box, the front row, there's like at the far right edge, there's the Ohio State sports information folks. There's like four or five seats for them, and then there's one like random open seat. I don't even know what the label was, who was supposed to be there. And then it's Chuck Culpepper of the Washington Post, and then me. And so in that open seat next to Chuck, like all of a sudden, just Lee Corso shows up, plops down. He had a security guard with him. And then maybe like a sort of an ESPN sort of handler type of person with him, and plopped down for almost the entire game. I think he may have stayed actually through the end right there in the press box watching. And he got a hot dog slathered in mustard.
Glizzy.
And
as one should.
Downed it.
Yeah. Mustard only. And love
then,
it.
And then he got
no ketchup.
Another hot dog slathered in mustard. So, yeah, boy was taking out a couple hot dogs.
Doing the Costco challenge. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. And he had trouble just eating because so many people were coming up to him, right? Like we were like, oh, there was a line. At one point, there was a line of like.
So it's like a receiving line at a wedding.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Sort of like good that. Yeah. Him, and he's sitting there in the tux. So it did look like that.
It was cool. Let me tell you something. Cool. If my last day at work is eating hot dogs in a tux while people are in line to give me well wishes, that's how you end the American dream, folks.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. At a football game, at like a top 10, top five matchup football game. At some point, poor Lee, and I mean, you know, eating a hot dog slathered in mustard in a tuxedo is a risky business, It didn't, you know, I think there was a little bit of, let's just say that tux is going to the dry cleaner.
Okay. It should go to the Hall of Fame.
It should go to the Hall of Fame.
Maybe in there one day.
Yeah. With the mustard.
For the career, yes, but also for the day he had yesterday. When we come back, we'll talk about a game where Lee Corso might have been the only person in America on the right side of it. Talk Bama, Florida State when we come back. Welcome back to the College Football Inquirer. We talked about Lee Corso. Ross sat with Lee Corso at the Ohio State-Texas game. Lee Corso, of course, known as the Sunshine Scooter, former Florida State player, beloved by his alma mater, loves his alma mater, was the only person on the College Game Day panel and maybe the only person in the United States of America to pick Florida State to beat Alabama on Saturday. And holy crap, boys, did Florida State beat the hell out of Alabama on Saturday.
Gus Malzahn is the horror movie villain for Tuscaloosa. We're on the ninth iteration of this franchise. No one expected with all of the existential angst
Gus goes to space? Gus in space?
we certainly won't have to deal with that. And then you open the pressure chute and there's like Malzahn just with a blank eating grin on that sideline. One observation, those of you who are in stadiums yesterday will not recognize this. I have a weird setup to do the games. I won't get into it, but I don't have audio on usually. The games are muted. If you watched Alabama, Florida State on mute yesterday, do you know what you would have been convinced of? That Gus Malzahn is the head coach at Florida State. The cut to on the sidelines, y'all, it was 5-1 for Gus over Norvell. The focus was obviously on Malzahn, what he's done with Castellanos. We can get into it, but like, it is amazing to see. Like, I can only imagine, like, we can get into the Florida State joy of this, but can you imagine all of the eggs you have in the offseason as a Bama fan? Then you go down to Tallahassee and you see that dude on the other side of the field.
Well, but the thing is, I've seen that dude. Like, I was at one of the UCF games last year, and I remember just standing there in the press box yelling at them to snap the ball when they had numbers and when the defense was confused. And like, it was like, what happened to Gus? Like, where'd you go, man? You used to love this stuff. And That was vintage Gus. That was, the defense is confused. We're going to run the ball. We're going to hit a pass. We're going to immediately line up and run it right down their throats. We are going to keep coming at you. We're going to have an efficient passing game. Tommy Castellanos' stat line was a Nick Marshall-ass stat line. Like, yes. if you watched Auburn in 2013 and 14, he's a future NFL cornerback. He could throw very well, but he could complete passes in that offense because they just kept coming at you. And that's what they did in this game, is they just kept sending waves at Alabama. And
Andy, they ran power read until, I mean, they could have run power read for the entire second half. This was vintage with him. Yeah,
I was
in
the air.
Basically, what they were doing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So they were. I'll put it this way. I got a lot of texts from Auburn people yesterday. Yeah. A lot of people being like, "Oh man, this record sure does sound like our band." Like this was vintage Auburn offense under Gus. Yeah, absolutely. Castellanos,
49 carries for 230 yards. So it's a 4.7 yard average, which is a good average. Not a great average, but when you do it for 49 carries, it means you have physically dominated the other team.
Yeah.
So that's what made that so incredible. And you know, he was an efficient passer, but not an insanely great passer. I mean, I believe it was 14 and 19 for like 150 yards. Nine of 14.
Yeah, just 150 yards or 9 completions.
Yeah, 10.9 yards per attempt. Yeah, it was great. It was very efficient. Yeah.
They ran to set up his pass for sure. By the way, 230 to 87 rushing differential. Are you freaking kidding me?
Yeah, so
17 yards rushing for Alabama in the second half.
Crazy stat. Alabama had 55 rushing yards on the first drive. And by the way, first drive, you're like, Ryan Grubb's back with Kalen DeBoer. Yeah. The band's back together. This is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
They had 55 rushing yards the first drive. At the 151 mark of the third quarter, they had gained 2 more yards on the ground since that 55 yards. It was wild.
And they never really went. Part of it is you're playing from behind, obviously. But they never really, it's like they didn't trust themselves to go back to it and slow the tempo of the game down. I don't know if that was some anxieties with their defense. There's a lot to discuss here. I want to kind of shout out on my other show, Phantom Island, this summer. I had a Florida State fan that was more depressed and anxious about this defense than they were. I think they kind of assumed Gus would come in knowing Norvell will fix some problems on offense. They were unsure about Castellanos, but defense was really where this anxiety was. This feels like we've got a theme today, Andy, by the way. Defensive coordinators coming in first or second year. We'll talk about LSU in a second. Tony White and the shift to the 3-3-5 here sure did seem to fix everything that ailed Florida State, because I think there's a preconceived notion amongst fans of power programs like helmet schools that this is kind of an exotic scheme. It's kind of a nonsense thing that you do when you're trying to...
triple option of defenses.
Yeah, and you're trying to compensate for something you don't have. And at Florida State, you should be able to have talent, full stop, to run a traditional 3-4, a traditional 4-3. Doesn't matter, guys, because they ran a 3-3-5 yesterday and absolutely walloped the run game for Alabama.
Because you can. It messes with your run fits. It messes with your rules as an offensive lineman. Nothing makes sense. It's one of those things you have to... I call it the triple option of defenses, because you really have to plan special for it. You have to have separate rules for everything it does versus everything a more traditional 4-3 or 3-4 does. The other problem with the 3-3-5 is that you can make it look like those other ones so easily.
Yeah,
but you don't know. Like, that hybrid safety can be almost anywhere. And the safety linebacker hybrid guy, that they always have some kind of cool name for him. It's like a Rover or a Strike or a Cobra
Dog
or whatever.
Star. Yeah. I always love that.
But,
yeah.
Razor. But that person is, you have to kind of find that person where they're lined up on every play to figure out what they're doing, because your run fits are going to be weird. Like, it is a very confusing defense to play against. And, you know, it's not a junk defense, though. I think that's the now the reputation has changed. When Joe Lee Dunn was doing it in the 90s, people were like, oh, he's just trying to, you know, give Mississippi State a chance. Now, enough people have used it that you realize, okay, this is how you can defend in a standard way. And if you have really good athletes, this can be a very effective defense.
Well, Andy,
we saw it
about
in Nebraska, right? The last couple
years.
They had very good athletes. Like, they had great guys up front, like Nash Hutmacher, the polar bear.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's Tony White was a good defensive coordinator at Nebraska. remember when Chip Kelly left UCLA, Tony interviewed for the head coaching job there that Deshaun Foster got. So, you know, Tony, and I had him on a list of coordinators who could be bound for a head coaching job. If Tony has a good year here at Florida State, he's getting a head coaching job.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I don't know how picky he is, but absolutely. And
he should be picky now, honestly, because it's one thing to do this at Syracuse for a couple of years and look like sort of a statistical aberration, than to go to Nebraska and fix what ails them, and then finally to climb to this level and be this dominant. I think he's going to have the choice of a lot of places. And by the way, FSU, I've made jokes about FSU's financial situation before because it's funny. But I think they would also easily pony up to keep him around if he wanted to stick around and be
choosy. They aren't going to have to figure out. They can't afford Mike Norvell's buyout, which is
not a conversation
we need to have anymore.
Nope,
but
no. Nope.
Can I throw another buyout at you?
$60.1 million. Let's go.
$60.1 million is Kalen DeBoer's buyout, which now we have to talk about because. Guess what? When you decide you're going to replace Nick Saban in Alabama and you accept millions of dollars to do that, we talk about your buyout after game one of season two because you've lost four games in 14 that Nick Saban never would have lost. The one loss last year to Tennessee, fine. That was a good team, playoff team. You were on the road, close game. That nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Vandy, Oklahoma, Michigan, this game. Those are games Nick Saban never would have lost.
All 13, I think 12 or 13 plus point favorite in all those games. By the way, Tommy Castellanos, you remember the offseason he gave the interview, I think you guys had
Pete Nakos, yeah.
And he said like Nick can't save them. He just started.
Tommy's a freaking oracle. Morning,
yeah, now this morning he started selling the Nick Can't Save Them shirts. For $35
yes,
a pop,
sir.
You can buy a Thomas Castellanos Nick Can't Save Them shirts. It's great.
This is what capitalism should be, America. I have two stats. Kalen DeBoer for all of his offensive wizardry, and I'm not trying to say that tongue in cheek. I thought Grubb coming back, Andy, was going to be an improvement. That's not really against Sheridan or any of the other guys on that staff. I really thought they'd be effective this year. They did wonders with Penix. They were amazing at Washington. Every game that they rush for less than 100 yards at Alabama, they've lost. It's a very simple recipe. This goes back to even like losses like Vanderbilt last year. Second statistic, and this is my area, guys. This is what I've made a career on. Alabama, as an insane fan base, has never dealt with what we're looking at in the social media era. We are talking, guys, about something
about that.
In the early millennium. We are reaching a Shula-esque possible state of things. I can say DeBose, but then we'd have to get into a history lesson. Guys, buckle up. Not you two. You two were veterans of the war.
No,
there's a generation of us. There's a generation of us. The kids don't know, Ross.
Twitter started
an entire generation has no idea.
Too, by the way, so it's like this is going to be the Twitter. I don't even know what to expect. It could get ugly.
Well, and DeBoer, he's smarter than this. Thankfully, the one coach in America who can't blame the predecessor for what he left behind.
But he could try. I'd like to see it.
But it's funny because Saban did have the rough first year. They lost to Louisiana Monroe. He went 12-0 the first 12 games of his second year. The first year, we'll talk about what Shula left behind. Probably their best player was a linebacker named Jimmy Johns. He got arrested selling drugs in the parking lot of the football complex. Like that's what Nick Saban took over. What Kalen DeBoer took over was a stockpile of NFL talent.
And a war machine from hell.
The problem here, the biggest issue, is not that they've lost these games. It's that none of these games have been fluky losses. These have all been, you just got straight up beat by Vanderbilt, by Oklahoma, by Michigan that had all its best players opt out, and by Florida State. So you can say, and he said this on Saturday, you can say this isn't last year. No, it looks exactly like last year, dude.
This is, this opens a whole world of possibilities when it comes to not only the power balance, because I don't know what y'all, we don't really do picks here, but I'm pretty sure I had said on this show I'd penciled in a Texas-Alabama SEC championship, and of course both of them have lost.
I said Alabama is winning the SEC. I said Alabama is winning the SEC. I am very much off that now. Because there's no way if you're going to play like that.
Yeah, My SEC pick looking good, boys. The Tigers, the LSU.
Oh, yeah.
Very good. I believe that's what we call a transition in the business.
I like it. It is a dynamite segue to the game I was at last night. Picture perfect, glorious night in Clemson, South Carolina. Mm. It was 68 degrees. The skies were clear. Everybody was the level of pants in the crowd was just incredible. Like
the orange pants.
If I were a Clemson fan, if I were a Clemson fan, I would wear the khakis that have the tiger paws all over them. I would own 17 pairs of those. And then you got the LSU fans with the prowling tiger on their khakis. It was so beautiful. It really was. and as a sports writer, and you two can appreciate this, Clemson LSU is the one matchup where you'll never accidentally wear the team colors to the press box.
No. What I love about LSU on the road, and I'm sure they were super psyched about this kind of weather streak we've had in the South, is that LSU on the road gets to dress differently because it's not hotter than the hinges of hell. You actually can maybe throw on, you can do a little layering in the wardrobe, boys. Yeah, so I'm sure LSU is having a hell of a time. Hey, because that's a trip up north when you're from I-10, right? Like that's it's breezy. You could have had a jacket on last night.
Godfrey, I live south of I-10, so I can tell you right now.
No, sir. Thank you.
It was like a brisk winter day, and
felt great.
Just a fantastic game. Holy crap! Did both defensive lines look fast?
Oh man, like, it was
watching,
so good.
Yeah, watching DeMonte Capehart and TJ Parker and Peter Woods on the Clemson side, and then Jack Pyburn and the LSU guys were getting after Cade Klubnik. LSU's defense looked completely different than the one 2 years ago that, you know, you had Jaden Daniels winning the Heisman Trophy and the defense being the worst maybe that LSU's ever put on the field. Blake Baker came in last year. They got statistically better, but they hadn't really changed their personnel very much. This year, they went into the portal.
Yeah.
And so, like, Mansoor Delane, who is a 3-year starter at Virginia Tech, he gets an interception in that game. You saw Jack Pyburn from Florida had the first pressure of the game, and they were all over Cade Klubnik. And look, LSU statistically dominated that game. If you look, probably twice as many yards. You felt like Nussmeier had a better game than Cade Klubnik. Nussmeier and Nussmeier in the second half, he's throwing seeds. He's putting it on people. Yeah. Right. The play to Berrien Brown, which initially was called a catch out the one. And then they look it on the video board and you see the LSU offensive lineman going touchdown. And so they review it and it looks like a touchdown at first. And then you're like, oh, wait, he didn't complete the catch. The throw that Nussmeier made on that play, I don't know how many guys in college football can make that throw.
I think this is what I want, guys. I think this is, you know, we trended as a sport to a excessively offensive brand identity for a couple of years. But we throw this and Texas Ohio State together. There's a big difference in this game, which was experienced quarterback play, elite quarterback play, dare we use the E word. But the idea of good quarterbacks against amazing front sevens and two defensive coordinators in Baker and in Tom Allen, who comes over from Penn State, who like to send pressure in fun and weird, and they're coming from the B gap, they're coming from this gap, they're coming from the boundary. This was, even for the low score, I think the most entertaining primetime. This is the kind of TV show we want out of college football. That's what I wasn't there, and it felt theatric, even though it was so low scoring. And I'm so happy that we're back to these drives mattering when they can actually occur. It was a great
TV show. Yeah, it didn't feel like it was boring. Like, no. It was low scoring, but not boring.
Like, I was at a boring game.
You kind of were at a boring game, Ross.
Yeah. You were at a narrow, like, heavy game.
The defenses at your game were just too good. I think Godfrey's got a good point. I think if Julian Sain and Arch Manning were third-year starters.
Experienced.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
It would look different.
Similar.
Ross, how many rollouts did Arch have where he's hitting a guy in the ankles? And I think the difference is Nuss and to some degree, Klubnik as well. And I still think I'm buying Klubnik. This was a really good defense. Were able to make impressive throws under pressure. It felt like both that these defenses were creative and effective in moving the quarterback around, but it also conversely felt like the quarterbacks were effective at adjusting and moving the pocket and still actually getting the ball down the field. I want to shout out Blake Baker, Andy. I don't think I was hasty in writing off the defense last year. It's just so obvious now it was a personnel issue that they couldn't catch up with. And it's very similar to... Oh, go ahead.
Remember, Blake Baker didn't get hired till January.
Right.
And I think that was the problem, is the winter portal was basically done. And so they didn't really have a chance to upgrade the defense. Remember, they looked at some guys in the spring, and the prices on the guys with the spring were out of sight. That's where
they didn't want to spend money.
Brian Kelly's like, we don't pay players. Yeah, you don't want to pay the asking price of these players, which was correct, by the way. He was correct in that. This year, they did it right. When the portal opened in the winter, they went and got the pieces they needed.
Yeah, like the money part of this is like, you know, I hate to like go into all that, but it is.
Oh, you did a great story.
It mattered last night.
Yeah, it really, I dove into it back in March when I visited Baton Rouge to talk to all like these LSU donors who basically were saying, you know, for years, sort of the LSU coach, Brian Kelly, and maybe even some at the highest levels of the university were basically like, we don't do that. Like, we're not going to pay these guys this exorbitant amount. I remember, I think on our last pod, we talked, Godfrey, you were like, jaw hit the ground, because I think I explained it how, I don't even remember who it was, had the idea, I guess it was Aranda, Baylor, had the idea of like paying players the same amount. Brian Kelly had the same idea in 2020, 2021, and 22. Like, that's what they did. Everybody got the same. He told me that in his office in like 21 or 22, he told me that's what they were going to do. And that's what they did. I think they spent $5.5 million on the 2023 roster. They spent maybe $7.5 or $8 million on the 2024 roster. This roster, over $15 million.
Ross, that's why you're a good reporter, is that he probably told you that and you just nodded and wrote that down. Whereas I would have been like, bro, what the hey guys, really telling, by the way, we just talked about a Virginia Tech program 2 weeks ago that is facing the existential crisis, the crossroads of the sport. Guess what? Game-changing play by former Virginia Tech member of the secondary, now on LSU. This is why we talk about all this stuff, guys.
And by the way, speaking of Virginia Tech, speaking of spending on rosters, Xavier Chaplin, the left tackle who left Virginia Tech, part of the Auburn offensive line that mauled Baylor's defense to an average of 6 yards per carry on Friday night.
This isn't rocket science.
The people who spent wisely got rewarded on Saturday.
Yeah, and not surprising too, like we're talking about all these Virginia Tech players who left. Not surprising that their athletic director 2 weeks ago went before the board of trustees, basically begging for more university funding, right? I mean, Andy, this is going to drop after the Virginia Tech game against South Carolina. So, you know, if you're listening to this, you know what happened. We don't. Andy, I think, will be there. Like, but that's going to be a really interesting game to see how the Virginia Tech handles all these departures.
Yeah, it's a bad scene right now. Now, I could say this and they could upset South Carolina, but
I doubt it.
And the thing is, we just talked about Florida State, which had kind of made its identity of we're going to reshape ourselves through the portal every year. And then last year it all fell apart because they got the wrong people out of the portal and the chemistry didn't work and the team quit. You do have to be careful with this. And that's Clemson's the one that didn't do this. But I will say, like, if you watched Will Help play on Clemson's defensive line on Saturday night, that's one of the three transfers they took. That dude was awesome. Like, he's really good.
Guys, what if everything is true from the last 5 years? You need to be active in the portal. You need to evaluate the same way that you would a professional model of free agency. You need to spend money, you need to raise it, but then also you still have to have an effective high school recruiting apparatus, a blueprint, that machine that we relied on for our talent 100% for the entire history of the sport. That still has to happen. Right? Clemson's a great model. Florida State's a great cautionary tale. And if Florida State comes back this year, it's not because they're hitting some sort of bingo machine this year and going good portal, bad portal, good portal. It has to be both. When Florida State was good a couple years ago, there was high school talent that they recruited, developed, and brought up alongside of the transfers.
Well, and I'll give you an example from LSU's first defensive possession last night. So I mentioned Pyburn got the first pressure. He forced Klubnik to make a bad throw on first down. On third down of that possession, P.J. Woodland, who's a second-year player that LSU recruited out of high school, comes on a corner blitz and sacks Cade Klubnik. Like, it's got to be the mix of the two.
Yeah.
It has to.
Yeah. Well, and tying this into LSU, when I was there for that story back in February about the money and the roster, I met for over an hour with Austin Thomas, who's their general manager. And he had this, you know, the big board, like all the GMs and stuff have. And he was going through stuff. It was a fascinating conversation. And he even like showed me his computer, which had like the rev share sort of distribution stuff and how they're doing things. And, you know, I mean, they're not doing anything completely different than anybody else is doing. But one of the things he said was, you know, we want our ideal. He sort of broke it down into three buckets of spending. You know, one bucket is retaining current players. The second bucket is going out and getting transfers. And the third bucket is high school players. And I think they don't want it in quite in thirds. I think they want like more like 50% high school and like maybe like 20% transfer. And then you want to retain, you know, 25-30% of your guy. You know, they kind of broke it down sort of like that. I think I have to go back to my store to get the right numbers, but it was interesting how he broke it down. But basically it was like, you know, we want to sign 20 to 25 high school players. We want to sign maybe 5 to 10 from the portal at a need position. And then we want to try to retain, you know, all of our players that we want, you know, that we want to keep. And that can be certainly a big group. So
yeah, Clemson's actually the ideal of that. You spend the most to retain your best players.
Yeah.
You spend to get guys, good players out of high school, and then you go into the portal and get guys that fill exact specific needs that you need to fill right now. And that's what Dabo did this offseason. It's what Kelly did this offseason, but they had more exact specific needs that needed to be filled right now on their defense than Clemson did. And I'd say Austin Thomas should be patting himself on the back today, because it looked like he did a very good job filling that group out.
So I'm sorry, I want to be sure to correct myself on the numbers, because I wish we went back to that story. I don't want to, because I definitely had a little flip there. So he said that, so Thomas told me that he wants the team to be made up 55-60% of retention players.
Yeah,
retained players. And he's talked about the stability. Scott Woodward, the AD, talked about this too, the stability and the culture. That's like the culture center nucleus of the team. High school players, 25-30%. And then portal players, 10-15%. You know, is kind of how sort of they want to break it down.
That feels like if you were writing out a formula there, that if you are effective in A, you can keep C down, but if you A being the retention and culture,
that's
but if
right.
if there's yep. any issue with A, then you're going to have to jump right past B and start inflating on. It sounds like we're okay with a single digit percentage of turnover, because maybe we run a guy off, maybe it doesn't work out. That's going to happen at every program, but we really want to avoid heavy spending on that free agency market in the portal. We want to keep that as the lowest number of those three. That seems like the best philosophy right now.
If you are
a top tier team, by the way, I'm talking about these are champagne.
Yeah, if you
problems.
Want to win the national title.
Yeah, for sure.
Gentlemen, LSU looks like a team that can make the college football playoff. Obviously, there's a very tough SEC schedule to go, but that was a huge win there in what looked like the best game of the night. Glad I was there. When we come back, we'll talk about why we should never, ever pick games again, and then we'll pick a game.
Yay.
Welcome back to the College Football Inquirer. And just a reminder, you can watch us on the Yahoo Sports Network on most of your smart TVs. If you go to the home screen, you probably see the Yahoo Sports Network. It's called Free Ad Supported Television. And you click that, and you've got all of our shows, including this here very show. And if you want to watch it on your device, on your phone, on your tablet, go to yahoosports.tv. You can watch all of our shows 24/7. Gentlemen, we had a segment. I thought we were going to name it I've Got a Feeling, where we each give out one game against the spread. I think I want to change the name to I've Got a Burning Sensation.
Yeah, feelings are bad.
We were
not
0
all
for 3.
Feelings are good.
We were
not
terrible.
All feelings are good.
Poo.
And then I find out from Andy off the air that you had talked to someone on an opposite staff of what I picked. And you're like, yeah, I should have talked to you about that. And I was like, well, why didn't you?
Yeah, because you had San Jose State against Central Michigan. I had a feeling that was going to be a low scoring game. Shout out Sean Cronin, the DC at Central Michigan. It's his first coordinator gig. I met him when he was a grad assistant under Urban Meyer at Florida years and years ago. And they had a great game plan for San Jose State. Now, San Jose State also missed some field goals, which was not good for them.
Yes.
But that was a tough one. I gave you Syracuse and Tennessee. I said Syracuse would cover. And I, you know, in the middle of the third quarter, I tweeted out, I need to have that erased from the internet. And then Syracuse gets within 12 with about five minutes to go. And I was like, oh, Undertaker coming out of the coffin gift. Yeah, it's time, boys. Yeah, Tennessee won by 19.
Well,
so they covered.
The Huskers had it for me.
Yes.
They had a 10-point lead. They seemed to be coasting. And then,
God, that was a
I don't know
game.
If it was Travis Kelce or Swifty up in the press box. The Bearcats, you know, scored late. And
that was
and really,
Ross,
we're
that game
making
was the
it
opposite.
Tight.
Yeah. That game was the opposite, boys, of like watchable, great TV product where like I watched about half of that. And I was like, God, maybe we don't. All right, this sport. All right, let's just go back.
Thankfully, I was outside on my patio that night with a cigar and a bourbon to watch that because I needed both.
You need a secondary, you need a secondary pursuit. That was some rough football, as Nebraska is wont to provide. So
the lesson here is we should never pick games. Of course, we will continue to pick games
every week.
On every Thursday, we'll give you one, and hopefully one of us will actually get one correct.
Well, if you're tuning in for some sort of advanced analysis for wagering purposes, then you've made a wrong turn in several directions.
Actually, if you do that, you should just mail us your money.
Or fade us.
That's right.
Just fade
that's
us.
A good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. I said at the beginning of the segment, you shouldn't use this as any kind of like, you know, analysis.
You warned them.
Yeah. So fade us all year is the actual point of this. What are we picking now?
Well, we're going to pick. So this game is Ross is going to this game. This show is dropping just before this game. So we may be a lot of people's pregame show for the Miami Notre Dame game in South Florida. And I just want to know what's you guys' sense as, you know, we're a few hours away from kickoff. Where are you at on this thing?
What's the Ross? Spread?
2.5, the Irish?
Yeah, it's Notre Dame by 2.5. I on my show on three, I picked Miami money line because that was my question is, if I think Miami's going to cover with a spread that small, I may as well just say they're going to win outright because more often than not, if they're going to win, they're going to win by more than 2.5.
So, one thing everybody should be aware of that could impact this game, obviously, down here in South Florida in the summer, is weather. So it's supposed to be cooler than normal at kickoff. I think it's supposed to be around 80, 81 degrees, but it is supposed to rain. It's incredibly humid down here right now, like insanely humid.
No offense.
So, of course, I didn't pick the team with the best. Well, I mean, they both have good offensive lines, but I think Notre Dame might have the best one in America. And maybe the best back in America, Jeremiah Love. So,
The rain tends
to favor the Irish, I think.
No, yeah, it's supposed to rain. Like, it could rain from like 4 o'clock to like 8 or 9 o'clock. God. So, it could rain for like 4 or 5 hours. And so, the field could be a mess. I lean toward Notre Dame on this one, all the reasons that Andy's talking about. But obviously, the new quarterback, the young quarterback, Carr, you know, that's concerning on the road, just sort of a similar like Manning thing, right? On the road, hostile environment. I don't know that Ohio State's crowd or Miami's crowd is going to be as loud and boisterous as Ohio State's crowd.
Oh,
but
they can be on the right occasion. And there's the dude who shaves the U into his chest hair. He's absolutely terrifying. He's in one of the end zones. Interesting. You bring this up, Ross, and I hadn't thought about this till just now. Having watched Arch and Julian Sain against those defenses and then watching Garrett Nussmeier and Kate Klubnik against those defenses, well, in both cases, you had first-year starter against first-year starter, and then you had veteran against veteran. In this case, you have first-year starter against Carson Beck, who's entering his third year as a starter at a high-level, high-profile program. He's been through this. This environment will not faze him in the least. I had not thought about it that way, but that really is an interesting wrinkle to this game.
No offense to Mr. Staples, but that rain that hit Florida State, like, was that third quarter? I was like, oh, no. I was like, this is why we visit and we don't live, people. This is, you got to be built.
I
got to be built
you,
for that.
You mentioned I-10 earlier in the show. I-10 between Tallahassee and Lake City. Lake City's where you head south on I-10 or on I-75. I have been through the most torrential downpours of my life between Tallahassee and Lake City on I-10. When that rain hit, I was like, I've seen this on my windshield.
Yeah.
This is horrific. This is absolutely horrific. And I was like, God bless those Florida State fans because they've been waiting for this for an entire year. Like, they're not moving. They're just going to stand here in
Yeah,
most likely a biblical flood.
I was about to say,
not moving.
It felt very biblical in its timing, if you will. This is not a pick. This is what I am interested in, okay? Because I don't feel confident in the Hurricanes in any way, shape, or form amongst competent teams. I'm looking for competency. I'm looking for a new defensive coordinator in Corey Heatherman to maybe shore up some of the, like, kind of brain-busting gaffes of last year. I want to see what kind of consistency Carson Beck brings in on day one, right? I liked their offense last year. And then I would also like to, in a big game, in big moments, hey, guys, have we worked on the decision-making matrix on the sideline for Miami? That's a nice way of saying, can you assure me that Georgia Tech from 2 years ago is never going to happen again, ever? Because Notre Dame has deficiencies relative to what we're replacing, but I trust that Notre Dame staff infinitely more, even if Miami is a better football team.
I hope people were watching us.
I hope people were watching. You got to get that in
because this happened to me and the old pod with Dan and Pat routinely. In fact, I just got up like in the hotel room. If people who are just listening didn't see, Andy waved away. I would think a maid.
They were coming to get the sheets.
Yeah, they were coming to get the sheets. And that happens to me all the time. In fact, mid pod, you may have saw me get up and I locked my door so that wouldn't happen here.
Andy, but, that was an effect.
There was a great video of Urban Meyer on a boat a few years ago. Where a buddy wanders into his shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
May or may not have been.
It's a reflection. Yeah. You can see the reflection from his computer. The reflection of the guy who wandered in, I think, like shirtless in a bathing suit. It was all very weird.
Yeah. I don't know if he was smoking something or drinking something, but Urban did not want him in the shot.
No, definitely not. Yeah. So anyway, didn't mean to derail, but with the hotel maid service, your point.
No, look, Miami. That makes a lot of sense. Doesn't that fit the vibe? If something unexpected walks into frame, that kind of feels like the Miami decision making matrix.
That's
like
you want
to subscribe to Miami's entire definition, culture, whatever you want to say, going all the way back to the 80s of, well, damn, we can pay players now and they can be ruthless and they can meet the modern age of college football and be Miami again. And all of that is true on paper, and they've put the money out there and we're doing the Ruiz stuff and they got their homegrown guy who's Cuban and played and all these things, right? Just coach a competent football game in a big situation. And then I'll be the first person to sign up and say, hey, the U's back. They're formidable. This is a serious program. But they've just been so deflating in such key moments the last couple of years.
I cannot wait to see what happens. Ross, you're going to be there. Mm. You had a delicious steak last night. That's the photo. I'm sitting at Clemson. And I get this photo comes through because Ross, for those who don't know, Ross was trying to pull off something. He had a little tight wire, you know, high wire act going.
He did
in Columbus. But not with a private jet.
Jet. It was tight. Like my flight act was 5:50 p.m. It was a noon kickoff. Thankfully, the game was really, really fast. Like it was, the last 10 minutes or the last 3 minutes of the game took 20 minutes. If not that, it would have been 2.5 hour game, but it was still only 2:50 or right around 3 hours. And so I was able to go to the Sarkisian press conference. Actually, when he left his presser, then I left and basically ran with my backpack on and all that to my car, got in my car at 4:30 p.m. So an hour and a half before departure, I was in a bumper to bumper for 30 minutes. And that's when I was scared I was probably not going to make it. But then as soon as I got through a certain section, it was just 10 straight minutes to the airport. Got to the airport at 5:05 p.m.
Yes.
45 minutes before departure. So I got through security and I was good to go. Even had enough time to change out of my wardrobe and get into the comfortable flying gear. It's a 2 hour flight. So by 10 PM, I was sitting at Prime 112 and had me a steak and all that good stuff. So
what I'm hearing is where's the Yahoo jet? That's what I'm hearing.
No Yahoo jet. They didn't send the jet for me, Godfrey.
This is really important.
It'll come.
Yeah. I've been here 3 weeks and I'm saying, where's the jet? This is going great. My HR review is going to be fantastic.
Exactly. Gentlemen, there is one more game before week one concludes. Labor Day at night, TCU, North Carolina, Bill Belichick coaching college football. It's real. It's actually going to happen. And I still, again, I've seen the press conferences. I saw them announce Gio Lopez as the starter. I'm not going to believe it, boys, until I watch him saunter out there in his hoodie in Chapel Hill on Monday night. And then we will really be through the looking glass at that point.
I'm excited to see what he chooses to wear exactly. You know, what kind, I mean, would it be some kind of sweater hoodie? Would it be cut off? I'm not sure. The
will it be mutilated?
Or, I mean, what, what is this going to look like?
I realize I'm the one in the sport coat right now, but what an effete, what a bougie type booster class. What a Argyle sweater type rank and file, you know, let's bust out the silver for the luxury box. And then you hire the dude who absolutely looks like he won like a round robin bum fight on his best day. And this is what you paid for. So, I mean, like, it's not like you can ask him and be like, hey, is there any way you could throw a collared shirt on? No, because he's not going to do it.
Nope.
Listen, I'm looking at you in your sport coat, Godfrey, and I'm like, and Ross in his backward hat, and I think, I should have worn my Fleetwood Mac t-shirt for this show. I'm going to embrace my Banner Belichick next time. I'm going cut off sleeves. Like,
let's do it. I slip shirts in sometimes.
Yeah. I'm trying to debate how I'm going to watch this game Monday night while at MetLife Stadium watching Oasis play. Because I'm going from Miami
to New York. Just brag there, buddy.
Monday morning. And I'm meeting my wife's taking the train from D.C. to New York, and I'm meeting her on a flight from Miami to New York. And so I'm going to have my phone up, but, you know, Liam and them are on stage.
The good news is Liam and Noel may actually get into a fight.
No, don't say that.
We've made it this far. Don't jinx it. By the way, that set list has been picture perfect for what you want after 20 years. Like, I'm very jealous. It looks very, very good.
Yeah, I'm excited.
We will not look back in anger, even if we get all these games wrong that we picked.
That's all I know.
Andy, don't acquiesce.
The best Beatles cover that was never a Beatles cover. Gentlemen, I hope everybody's enjoyed week one. I got to go cover South Carolina, Virginia Tech. Ross has to cover Notre Dame.
You said that like you had to clean the gutters.
I'm actually very excited. I gotta go mow the lawn.
Oh God, the line in Home Depot is gonna be terrible. Yeah. Like, that's how you just said that.
I apologize. No, I am very excited to see this game. Very excited to then watch on TV the one that Ross will be at. Yeah. And of course, we will be back together on Tuesday to break it all down. We'll talk to you then.